Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. I'm the producer, Caleb Keith, and I'm joined by our hosts, Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco. Follow these great minds as they answer pressing questions about theology, history, and apologetics. This show is brought to you by 1517 The Legacy Project, serving to proclaim the gospel to all people, especially those broken by the church. Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. I'm the host, Caleb, and today with me, as always, is Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco. Today we're talking about one of our last Lochi topics for the moment, last regularly scheduled one, and that's vocation. But before we head over to that topic, I just wanted to have some quick announcements. As we come to the end of these Lochi topics, we'd love for listeners to send us episode suggestions. Maybe topics that we didn't hit throughout these last 26, 27 episodes, and then also some topics that might need some re-clarification. We went over some stuff. We got some comments from people that said they'd love for us to go deeper or farther on some of these episodes.
Can we say we'll do it on anything but eschatology?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's...
yes, we should probably...
That's the one everybody asked me to do more on.
I know.
Of course.
We should probably pick a couple. We say we're, you know,
this or that. If you send in a suggestion, it's not a guarantee. So just know that we will kind of filter them and see if we have the time and the ability to go back over it, go over our notes a little bit for that. So there's a couple ways you can do that. You can send us an email at thinkingfellows@1517legacy.com. There is on our website at thinkingfellows.com a section where you can send a message to us, and that comes to my inbox. You can also send us a message on Facebook or Twitter for any suggestions, or a shout out on Facebook and Twitter for any episodes that you'd like us to do.
How does one shout out on Twitter?
Well, see,
capital
there's a,
letters?
There's a little at sign there, and yeah, they just tag us in the post.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Okay.
What's Twitter?
Thank you, Adam.
So, as you can tell, I'll be the only one reading those.
I actually had a Twitter account.
You
briefly,
did, yeah, briefly, and then
I
gone.
Did. I wrote, just wrote a blog about hashtagging.
Yet you really? Never used the hashtag.
No, I had to actually look up Wikipedia what a hashtag was before I wrote the blog, and then inserted a description of what a hashtag was from Wikipedia in the blog so that my readers who didn't know what a hashtag was would understand.
It's probably safe to assume most of your readers understand the concept.
Oh,
but. We digress. We're going to move on here. Because we're moving out of Lochi topics, and some people are definitely joining us for the first time, we have new listeners every week. I was going to have Dr. Keith go over and explain just what we meant by Lochi topics, what we covered, and maybe why people should go back if they're listening to this episode for the first or second one, why they should go back and listen to the old episodes.
Sure. When we say Lochi, what we're basically saying is just a topic, right? And in the ancient world, as they were trying to categorize thoughts, they used a method called the Lochi method, which was a categorizing of topics according to their importance or maybe their prevalence in material. And essentially, when we say we're going through the topics of the Lochi, it's sort of redundant to say that. But what we're saying is that we are going through topics of theology one at a time. And when we say we're doing that according to the Lochi method, we are trying to describe the fact that we're not hitting these topics randomly. They're not just popping up randomly as far as order and importance, that we attempted to start with those that are central and then work through the others as an interplay to that most central locus or that most central topic. All of us here at this table are Lutheran, so that means for us that we really start with the person and work of Christ, specifically in his dying and rising for us, for our justification, and then we address all of the other topics of theology in view of that, and trying at every turn to recognize how Christ's death and resurrection for us influences and affects all the other topics in theology. It's a systematic category. If our listeners are familiar with that, it's a way of just organizing the different thoughts and ideas and doctrines as we come across them in the Bible, in a way that can be understood and studied effectively. In Lutheranism, it was first used by Luther's co-worker and colleague, Philip Melanchthon. He wrote the first Protestant, and certainly Lutheran systematic theology, or organized system of theology, and it was called the Loci Communis Theologica, or the Common Topics of Theology.
Isn't it sort of similar to Aristotle, what he did in taxonomy and biology, where there's a tree that helps you to organize all the material?
It is, and you see it also in Cicero, in organizing how an orator is to, influence his audience, and even how one is to study a particular topic or a particular reader. And at the end of the day, I mean, it's kind of, there's a whole method, and I'm sort of arduously working on getting that Melanchthon's Loci method out there, because he describes the classical method too. And it has to do with reviewing sort of the entire body of a work first, going through it again, and then sort of examining the individual topics, and then going through it again and trying to weight those topics according to importance and prevalence, and then analyzing which topics play into one another, and then organizing them for the student accordingly. And so when we say that in the Loci method as used theologically, that's sort of what we're saying. So if you look at any particular systems, I guess you could say they're dogmatic theology or they're systematic theology, and you see where they start and throughout it where they sort of lend their focus, you're going to get a hint of what they think the Bible's all about.
Right.
And that's true with us too, in our systems of theology, and certainly in our Loci. And we started with the idea that there's this problem, in sin, and that very much according to along with Paul in the first three chapters of Romans, that we have a need for the Savior. We cannot help ourselves, and then God provides the answer on account of Christ and His death for us and His resurrection as the first fruits of our resurrection. And then everything else plays off of that. So as we address topics like the church or the sacraments or what are some of the other ones? We did the whole body at this point. Even eschatology, we were discussing before we recorded. They all tie back to that. And we're going in today.
Others notice that too. I had a Baptist friend, very bright. He actually read through our dogmatics. One of the he loved our high stance on the dependability of Holy Scripture on all things. That was what drew him in. But he kept reading. And he said, Rod, when you say that your position is Christ-centered in a way that other theologies are not, he said, I found that to be true. Every single locus was related to the doctrine of justification one way or another.
Right. And you even see that in our earliest confession, the Augsburg Confession, which Melanchthon wrote. By Article 4, you get to the doctrine of justification. And that's called the article upon which the church stands or falls, right? In other words, the whole house comes down unless we understand correctly Christ's person and work for us. And so that's how we approach this. So if listeners want to go back and listen to all the episodes, hopefully they recognize that when we say Loci, we're just talking about a topic of theology. We're discussing a topic of theology, and that we view all of those topics as touching to or relating to or jumping off from our salvation on account of Christ alone.
Yep.
And it creates a picture that I think is unique to Lutheranism and appealing for those who are in other systems who are looking for a certain type of assurance that they might not be getting. They might, or sometimes being told to look inside themselves for this assurance. And one of the things our listeners will hear time and time again through our recordings as we go through the Loci is this outward looking, this outside of us.
Yep.
How do we know that we're saved? We look outside of us. We look to Christ. We look to the proclaimed word of forgiveness. We look to His gifts and the sacraments, all relating back to Christ. And so, that's the Loci. I will at some point, I really hope in the next few weeks, get the Melanchthon's translation of the Loci method up on the Thinking Fellows website. It's sort of long compared to some of the other translations I've put up, but which is why it's taking a little bit longer. But I want to get it right. I want to explain all the classical references in it so that our readers can understand what's going on. But I think they'll find it useful for looking back on how we've approached this aspect of the Thinking Fellows and using it as sort of just a guide to what we did.
And it's brought us to sort of the end today with vocation, kind of where the rubber meets the road theologically in many people's lives. And so
And we should probably explain why, you know, why that's our last topic. Many systems end with eschatology.
Sure.
Right? Or the last things.
Start with creation and go to the end.
Right. And we're treating this sort of oddly. We're ending on vocation. And the reason we decided to do that, that's not always inherent to our systematics. It's not always inherent to our dogmatic theologies. But the reason we decided to do that, I think, is because our theology of vocation suggests that the answer to the question, which, you know, I always remember from Francis Schaeffer, how then shall we live?
Sure.
Is, you know, free before God and freely serving our neighbor.
Yep.
Right? Yep. Sometimes the phrase when we talk about, and this kind of gets back to good works. We did this a little bit in good works, but I think it fits here because we just went through all the topics of theology, which the listener might then ask, okay, great, now what?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And we're saying, okay, great, now what? You live. You're free.
Yeah.
It's sort of the hardest and the easiest answer to the, okay, then now what? Uh-huh. And it's, I believe, a uniquely Lutheran answer to say you are, in the words of Gerhard Ferdi and Jim Nestigan, free to be, and I always like to add what God has already declared you are.
Right.
Right?
Right. Good way to put it.
His child, you know, free before him, free to love and serve your neighbor, and so as we discuss the doctrine of vocation, we sort of flesh that out a little bit.
The most contemporary work by one of our fellows is Gene Veith, God at Work. And I think I've heard he's done a revised edition of that.
Well, it's not a revised edition as much as it's a, how would I say it? I think it's a more academic approach to the topic.
Okay.
The format is not quite the same. It's called Working for Our Neighbor, a Lutheran Primer on Vocation, Economics, and Ordinary Life.
Okay.
Is the new one. I read it over the summer. It's very good, but his classic work is God at Work.
Yeah, and he will openly say, I stole everything from Gustav Wingren, I think.
Luther on Vocation.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an excellent book. It's very down to earth, readable by pretty much anybody.
Yep.
Concordia uses it in a couple classes for students.
The background I think of, especially when I was working with InterVarsity and with evangelicals, the evangelical asks what your ministry is.
Yeah, that's that is the background.
And you say, well, I work for Boeing and I build an airfoil that's going to keep you in the air till you land. And he says, no, that's your job. I want to know what your ministry is. And our doctrine of vocation doesn't make that distinction.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that because you've used that example quite a bit. And I stole it when I was in New York at Christ Old Fast. And
sure.
I won't say the whole thing, but I was on the stage with somebody from another tradition. And we were talking about sharing the gospel.
Right.
Because it was actually a conference on vocation. And his was vocation in the workplace or something like that. And we were talking about sharing the gospel in your everyday life. And he basically said the classic evangelical answer, right?
Uh-huh.
That your vocation in your everyday life, in your workplace or whatever, is to focus on sharing the gospel at every moment. And I said, well, I used your example. I said, I'm not sure I want the engineer at Boeing to think it is number one priority while he's at work to share the gospel.
Yeah.
I'd actually prefer that he focus on making sure that airfoil he's designing is actually going to keep me in the air when I fly home to California.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, so it's, I think from the outset, we ought to acknowledge that the Lutheran view on this is sort of unique and is sometimes shocking to those outside of our own little world.
When you get down to some of the specifics of it, it comes from Luther saying that a woman changing the diapers does a better, more sanctifying work than any priest ever does.
Or had,
yeah. the thing that really changed Europe, I'd love to think, was the doctrine of justification by grace alone, through faith alone, on account of Christ's death alone. But actually, the thing that changed Europe was that there weren't two levels of Christians anymore. There was a priesthood of all believers, and that's what changed the whole thing in Europe. Of course, the doctrine of justification. But I have to allow that because it really is true. It was something else that brought the whole structure, you know, to a halt.
Yeah. Before Luther, vocation, calling, if you will, was only reserved. People were only called into the clerical class, whether it be secular clergy or monastic clergy.
Yep.
And it's, as far as I know, Luther's the first one to call, if you will, secular jobs, vocations.
Yep, I think
so. The first one. And that really revolutionizes everything.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, the mother, the vocation of being a mother is seen as a divine thing entirely.
Yes.
The office or the holding some military vocation is seen as a divine thing, interestingly enough.
Yep.
The magistrate, the butcher, the bread maker, and so on down the line.
Yep.
So when we say vocation, we're actually playing off of really Ephesians 2:10 type language that God has prepared all of these good works for us to walk in. In other words, that we all have a calling that is a calling, quote unquote, from God. And we're sort of clarifying, I think, a misunderstanding that means particularly like an ecclesiastical calling.
Exactly.
And it probably more properly and even in a more sanctified understanding of that is to realize that your calling is to serve your neighbor and that you start that with those people that are closest to you and you work out from there.
The other thing I think it's we have to say, we have every inclination in us from the old Adam to think, whatever this is, it's probably something I'm not going to like very much. And just the opposite is the case.
Right.
In other words, if God gifted you in particular areas, music, mathematics, engineering, you name it, it just could be that that's your vocatio, what you most enjoy doing.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't come to us intuitionally and immediately. Just the opposite comes to us.
Right. We ought to be suffering here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It could be do what you most love doing, and that could be the best way that you could serve your neighbor.
Yeah.
So, Adam, what was the history of this prior to this? Was it just the ecclesiastical callings?
Yeah, so in medieval society, you have societies divided up into three orders, those who fight, those who work, and those who pray. And the ones who pray, the clergy, whether they've been monastic or the local priest, they're seen as having divine callings. Everything else is just to sort of enable culture or civilization to move along. But in a way, everything else kind of serves the clerical order, to protect the clerical order. But then, in turn, though, to be fair, the clerical order does pray for the secular world. But there is an interesting thing. There's a hierarchy in medieval society that suggests that the highest thing you could do, regardless of what you've done up until this point, the best thing you can do if you want to make sure you're really fulfilling your calling from God is, you know, take some sort of holy order or go, you know, join a monastery, become a priest or what have you. And that you don't have, during the Crusades, there's this sense that the Crusaders are doing God's bidding, you know, they didn't use the term masks for God or anything like that, but there's a sense that God's behind all. But by and large, most stuff in the temporal, secular world is just seen as stuff that goes on to preserve life, to benefit, to strengthen, to maintain the church. And it's all arranged hierarchically. So those who work, the farmers, the feet of society, you know, medieval people oftentimes saw society as kind of a body. And the hands and the feet are the farmers, the laborers. They're seen as the lowest class. And it's not a caste system or anything like that, nor is it a class system the way a Marxist might see something.
Right.
But they're not seen as distinct or certainly not seen as fulfilling what God would have them do in doing those particular jobs, if you will.
Yep.
That's simply the clergy. Luther comes around, of course, as we said already, and calls it all divine. I mean, there's a one, I think it's on whether soldiers too can be saved, where he says, where he's addressing the concern of a lot of soldiers in Germany. And this is the time where, obviously, it's violent in the 16th century. You've got the Turks banging on the doors of or the gates of Vienna. And Luther has heard a lot of soldiers, probably who were influenced by Anabaptism, who are concerned about their salvation because their job is to kill the enemy.
Yep.
And if they kill the enemy, how can they be saved?
Yep.
And so Luther writes this work, Whether Soldiers Too Can Be Saved, and says, actually, what you're doing is a, he calls it a divine thing entirely. It's a Christian act of love and mercy to fight and slay the enemy because you're defending your neighbor. Mm-hmm. He says the individual Christian shouldn't be concerned about their own body so much, but if their neighbor is at risk, if their neighbor's life is threatened, then it's the obligation of actually every person, not just the soldier, to defend them, even if it means killing the enemy. And so he will, Luther's sort of strange on the, well, he's not strange, it's you got to be very careful in reading Luther on this, because he will say things that sounds like crusading rhetoric, but he doesn't mean that at all. He's just saying that the soldier, the magistrate, all these secular vocations are, the people who hold them are actually kind of, God is working through them as masks of, they're the hidden things of God in this world. You can't discern the details of how God's working there, but you know, big picture, that God is working through all these things.
Terrific exposition of it.
That was great. Well, we're going to take our first sort of advertisement break now. We'll be back in a moment.
Welcome to our break. Today we're going to talk about a book that we've talked about in the past, but it's been probably like 10 episodes. We're talking about Where Christ is Present, A Theology for All Seasons. And Dr. Francisco was a contributor to that book, and he's going to kind of talk about it a little bit and maybe highlight a chapter or two.
Yeah, so the book was edited by John Warwick Montgomery and Gene Veith. They probably need no introduction. They're probably... I mean, obviously, Montgomery is the leading Christian apologist has been for, I don't know how...
Since the death of C.S.
Since
Lewis.
Since he was able to read, maybe. So for decades. And Gene Veith is the sort of scholar on vocation, postmodernism, does a lot of...
fascism.
Yeah, just tremendous stuff. And they both got together... I think they were both at Patrick Henry College at the time, and as they put it in the back cover, they wanted to propose a book, or wanted to put together a book that would propose the kind of Christianity that is best suited for our day. And what they did then is collected a number of authors to write on the basic, almost like Loci topics, but of a different sort. So in the table of contents, you've got the introduction with Montgomery writing a chapter entitled "You Are Looking for a Church Home, or Perhaps You Aren't," and then the subject starts with Dr. Veith with looking at the religious landscape of the 21st century. Cameron McKenzie, who is sort of the, in my mind, one of the leading Reformation historians in our church body, the Lutheran Church.
He is,
and I think his real specialty is the English Bible.
Yep,
he's a teacher and a scholar and a gentleman like no other.
Yep.
He's got a look at the Reformation back then, and then the Reformation as it's understood now. And then he got chapters on the Bible, the authority of the Bible, Dr. Rosenblatt, The Way of Salvation, The Doctrine of Justification, Hal Sankbile, Means of Grace, Two Kingdoms by Todd Wilkin. So basically a who's who in the zoo of Lutheran theology, contemporary confessional, if you will, or conservative Lutheran theology. And you do, since we're talking about vocation, you've got Uwe Zeman-Netto with a chapter entitled Vocation versus Narcissists, and where he explores, kind of like what Gene Veith does in his work, God at Work, he breaks down systematically the Lutheran understanding of vocation, but then towards the end of the chapter suggests that it's this particular doctrine that really sets Lutherans apart in terms of their interaction in the public arena.
Yep.
For example, he's got one little section on, for all of us here, apologetics is near and dear to the heart, and he's got a little section on how vocation in many ways plays a role in the public witness to the gospel even. Mm-hmm. So a great book. I think it's about 250 pages, a little less than 250 pages long, written with the average reader in mind. This is not, it's footnoted and all that, but it's not a monograph. It's for the common Christian, especially, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Dr. Rosenblatt, you can tell me, for the person who's maybe evangelical or maybe Reformed or what have you, but is kind of unsettled where they are and is looking for a theology that corresponds to the text of Scripture.
Yep.
But is also relevant, if you will, for the day.
Think of C.S. Lewis's analogy. He said, my calling is to defend the truth of the gospel and bring people into the main hallway. Mm-hmm. But, he said, there's no nutrition and no warmth in the hallway. That's in the rooms. That's not my specialty. I defer to the priests on that. Mm-hmm. But you do have to find one room that you think is a better room than the other rooms. Mm-hmm. That analogy holds. It was written, I wrote what I wrote, and I think others would say the same, to that Christian who's just entered in and says, now what? Or where do I go? Or which do I choose? Or why should I choose this one rather than that one?
Yeah.
Great, yeah. It's available at shop.1517legacy.com, and it'll be posted on the webpage for this episode, as well as the show notes available on any of the podcasting apps. All right, so we're going to move back into our topic. We kind of talked about the history, the change of vocation when Luther came around, and I thought it'd be appropriate to say, so what does this mean now? Has there been a change in the way this has been addressed, and does the rest of Christianity have something like this? I think I find when I talk to evangelical friends or people outside the Lutheran tradition, they're a little more confused when I say vocation.
Sure. Sure.
Well, I had a question, too, for Adam. Adam, that was a great description of sort of medieval thought on this issue, and maybe throw it out to you and to Rod. Do you see us going back to that a little bit, where within the church we view sort of the every, maybe not in Lutheranism specifically, but maybe, but view the everyday, you know, workings of just the common person as lower than a particular calling to a group of people or a congregation or whatever?
I think there's a lot of great work that has been done on vocation. But I think personally, I'll give you a personal example. Growing up in the LCMS, I remember thinking, I'm a boy in the LCMS, and I believe this stuff. And I remember a pastor, my pastor in St. Louis, telling me, I don't even know if I was in high school. He said, you know what job you'd be really good at? You'd be a great pastor.
Oh, gosh.
And I remember thinking,
got that same thing.
That I, you know, if I'm a guy in the LCMS, this is probably what I should do. And so I ran from that, as you do, and enlisted in the military. But when I got out, that was still nagging, that was the only legitimate thing for a guy who's serious about theology or serious about his faith in the LCMS is to go off and go to seminary and whatnot. But I learned once I started studying Lutheran theology, that's not the case at all. And it was quite liberating for me to realize that's not the case. But I do wonder, I see it sometimes around in our churches where, it's wonderful for young men to aspire to the office of the ministry. It's wonderful. But that's not the only, as long as they don't see it as the only thing you can do to, as they might put it, serve God.
That's right.
You know, as you said earlier, Dr. Rosenblatt, whatever they're best suited for, you know, whatever they really enjoy doing. Yeah. And it might be speaking the word of God to people.
It might be.
It might be
auto mechanics.
Making the plane thing you were talking about.
Make the wing keep the plane.
Yeah.
Might be
foil.
Changing diapers.
It might be changing. Well, yeah. That's women's. I'm kidding. I've changed hundreds of diapers. I just changed two diapers about a week ago. Two kids that weren't even my own. I was like, wow, I've almost forgotten how to do this. I'm kidding, listeners.
That's funny.
But it is sort of built into us that one vocation is somehow more valid or more spiritual or more something or other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the medieval church, and it ain't Luther.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's I came across this 15 years ago, a work in the big critical edition of Luther's works that has not been translated into English yet. And I don't remember the exact title, but it's about the monastic estate. Mm-hmm. And it's a bunch of theses. And at the end, Luther concludes the monastic estate is an estate built by the devil.
Right.
But I remember kind of reading a bit of it. And he, in the theses, if I remember correctly, he traces a kind of historically the origins of the rise of the monastic estate and how this influenced the way Christians viewed clerical offices and how eventually it sort of elevated to this, the top of the hierarchy. And he says, this whole thing, there's nothing biblically about being a monk.
Yeah.
But I today, with a lot of this, I do see this, this is all anecdotal stuff, but I see this, the discussions concerning the office of the Holy Ministry.
I'm so glad you do those so I don't have to.
Where it's almost where they're creating a fourth estate. So in Lutheran views, there's three estates to life. There's the domestic estate, the household, your job, and so on. Then there's the political estate, that's governance. Then there's the spiritual religious estate, that's the church, if you will. And that's all there is, at least that's Luther's view. This fourth estate is something that's added to it. This special class of people who are holy, they've had hands laid on them, and they have this sort of special ability, almost like magic,
to do things. That's a move backwards.
Absolutely, yeah. And I can't point to a document, and I certainly wouldn't name names, but I see a bit of this, and I've seen some of this in some of our circles.
So what about and maybe Rod would be good on this, in evangelicalism. I mean, you started this out by saying, your evangelical friends would ask you, what's your ministry?
Yes.
I mean, to me, that sort of communicates the same thing,
sure.
Right? That
sure.
You're not doing ministry. Oh, they can't see that, air quotes. Doing ministry unless you are doing something specifically in the church. And our good friend Kurt Winrich would talk about this all the time. When he was a worship leader, that was... He was doing his ministry as a worship leader. But when he went to work at his investment firm, he was, that was his whole other life. That was the other Kurt. That wasn't the doing ministry Kurt.
Right.
I mean, is that sort of a reach back to this?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's totally accurate. And the difficulty is the same one the medieval faced. That is, I feel kind of shaky as an individual believer. Maybe what I need to do is to become a minister.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's the same sort of thing without the Latin.
Mm. That's good. All right. So, I mean, I guess I'll throw this out there. Have we fleshed this out yet? I mean, what does it mean to walk in one's vocation? Just basically to...
This is really wonderful news that you don't have to have what I just described hanging over your head like a sword of Damocles, that somehow the evangelical speak is, are you in God's perfect will or not?
Ooh.
And then to try and figure that out without any scripture. No. If you are doing something that connects with helping your neighbor, God sanctifies it in Christ. In other words, you're doing something spiritual even though you don't know it. Mm. Yeah. You're being a priest to your family or friends in ways that look totally humdrum or normal or whatever. Mm-hmm. And God sees it as your vocation, glorifying Christ no matter how low it looks. Mm. I think of the freedom of that.
Right, and to sort of to bring back to how we started this episode with the idea of the Loci and the idea of everything being brought back to the person and work of Christ, God sees it that way because Christ is literally standing in front of you.
Right.
And when he looks upon you, he sees what his son has done for you. He sees his son.
And what you do.
Right, and what you do. And on the basis of that, he says, I'm pleased.
Yep.
Right. Not on the basis of your actual sort of mustering within you the ability to do it well or not,
right?
But on the basis of Christ.
And it may have nothing to do with what you're doing Sunday morning under a pastor's care.
Mm-hmm.
Auto mechanic qualifies. Thousands of things qualify because it's propter Christum. It's under Christ's merit. Be free. Find what you'll be an artist. Whatever. you're hidden in Christ.
You are free to be what God has declared you are, his child. So now go be his child.
Yeah.
Right. Good.
Yeah, I think that about covers it. It's a shorter episode, but we did manage to cover everything, I think. I think we hit everything that needs to be talked about. Since we have time, I wanted to...
I can give her a recommendation, too. Not too long ago, Christ Hold Fast hosted one of their city conferences in New York City, and it was a conference dedicated specifically to vocation. And all of that video is making its way onto the Christ Hold Fast website one by one as it's edited. I'm trying to remember. Kurt Winrich, who's a good friend of the show, good friend of 1517, did vocation in sort of the professional world. I did vocation of father. Jessica Thompson did vocation of wife and mother. We had somebody that did vocation. His name's Loso, did vocation of artist. Just a really... David Kim did a vocation in the workplace or something. And those are all coming out little by little. I'd recommend that listeners watch those sort of with a discerning eye. Not all of those are from a position that we'd all agree with. But I think they all did a fairly good job of representing at least the reformational idea of
The very vocation. Fact that it was a category that was the category defining the gathering says something.
Right.
That's unusual. Right. Who's that?
And these are just short, I guess they call them TED Talks style, 20-minute at a pop with a little question and answer session afterwards. So they can go to ChristWillFast.org, I believe, and check that out. You can put that in the show notes. If listeners didn't get enough from hearing this, I think they'll get more, they can get a little bit more meat there. And then I'm sure Caleb will put all of the books we referenced in the show notes and maybe a few extra if we can.
If we can fit them, yep.
Yeah, if we can fit them.
Yeah, there's about, this is a good time to plug the website a little bit. If you haven't been to the Thinking Fellows website, I think most of our listeners get the show from iTunes, so they don't necessarily need to go to the website. But if you go to the website, there's extras there. The show notes in iTunes aren't as interactive as they are at the website. So at the website, I have pictures of the covers of various books, about three different things that we hit on that'll take you to the direct Amazon link to be able to purchase the book and find out more about the book. And then anything else that was in the show is mentioned there and hyperlinked also, so you don't have to type it in from your iTunes description and things like that. And the site has a couple other extras that you'll want to check out as well if you haven't been over there, including our donate page if you'd like to support the show. But before we go, I'd have it slotted out here to have Dr. Rosenblatt talk about a topic that many people love, but we haven't talked about on the show in a long time, and I thought it'd be a good way to just end, and that's the little work you did, The Gospel of Those Broken by the Church, and why that might apply to people. We were talking about here the evangelical understanding of vocation or your ministry might break people a little bit.
Yep.
And why this kind of ties into... being free.
Well, my target audience there was the people that would call themselves perhaps alumni of the Christian church. Maybe once were Christian believers, and something that went on within their parishes finally broke them. Now, that can be Wesley doing Christian perfection. That is, if you don't arrive there before you die, you are certainly damned. It can be all sorts of subjects, but the net result often is, I think I'm going to bow out. And I took as my takeoff point really bad use of the third use of the law. Now, Dr. Horton and I and all of us signed to, in the Formula of Concord, a third use of the law. Nobody knows more about it than Dr. Keith. But what I was saying was, if this is executed badly, then what he's saying about what your Christian life ought to be can be the breaking point. Now, with some, they leave really sadly because they had hoped so much, and that breaks them. And it's with tears or frustration. The other kind who leave because they are totally angry. They feel baited and switched. It sounded so good in the beginning. And then, lo and behold, they're led into a Christian parish where finally the basic message has to do with behavior and morality, not the gospel. and they just get angry, and they're not coming back, especially alpha males. Once you've done that to them, you've lost them forever. So I wanted to try to write to both of those groups, knowing that they occupied mental space like I've described, and try to put the gospel back in, apart from whatever their church did to them. And you find this in I found it in evangelicalism over and over and over and over and over and over again. They found it either trivial or morally repulsive and destructive, the stuff they were getting every single Sunday in curriculum or pulpit. And I wanted to say, I want to talk to you about how the gospel applies to you right there. At your most pissed off or at your most despairing, I want to talk to you about the gospel right there, where you are right now. So that was the attempt.
Well, and I definitely think you succeeded at that. I think many They've people
gone out
have
by
over
the
years.
Zillions in evangelical circles, Calvary Chapel and others, just gone out by the there's no charge. Pass it out to whomever you want.
And I'll have a link to that. There's a video version that you can watch on YouTube of you giving the lecture. There's an audio version on the 1517 website. And there's the transcript if you'd like to read it. So I'm going to make that available. And I think that pretty much closes up the show. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and subscribe either on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. See you next time.